384, Chapter 16, Georgia in the Civil War. Chapter Preview, Terms, Confederate States of America, Mint, Draft, Blockade, Bond, Inflation, Emancipation Proclamation, Casualty, Platform, Racism. People, Jefferson Davis, Abraham Lincoln, Francis Bartow, William H.T. Walker, Charles Olmsted, William Tecumseh Sherman, Henry Wirz. Places, Fort Pulaski, Fort Sumter, Atlanta, Fort Jackson, Fort Bartow, Fort McAllister, Richmond, Andersonville, Appomattox Courthouse. Since the American Revolution, the power of the national federal government and the power of the individual state governments had been an issue. The government under the Articles of Confederation had shown that a stronger national government was needed, and so the Constitution had been written. Since then, one of the big debates in the United States, even in our own time, has been around the question of how much power each should have. Other issues, including the tariff, had caused different opinions about the national and state government's powers, but they did not push the two sides to war. Although slavery and states' rights had been the issues that led to the South's secession, the immediate concern for Abraham Lincoln when he took office was not slavery, but keeping the United States together. He was not willing, however, to give in on the national government's right to forbid slavery in the territories, so a compromise that would bring the seceded states back did not work out. In the end, the North and South fought a four-year-long war that both preserved the Union and ended slavery. Although there were white Georgians who remained committed to the Union throughout the war, most, even those who had not supported secession, became enthusiastic Confederates. Georgia was important to the Confederacy because of its location, the supplies it produced, and the men it sent to fight. While Georgia saw some early military action along the coast, the actual fighting did not come to Georgia until late 1863 with the Battle of Chickamauga. In 1864, however, Georgia felt the full fury of war as the Union Army under General William Tecumseh Sherman fought its way to Atlanta, captured that city, and then marched to the sea. For enslaved Georgians, the fall of the state to the Union meant liberation. For all Georgians, black and white, it meant rebuilding the state in a new way. Page 386, Section 1, Georgia Goes to War. As you read, look for the event that began the Civil War, the advantages and disadvantages of the North and South, important battles such as Antietam, Vicksburg, and Gettysburg, the Emancipation Proclamation, terms, Confederate States of America, Mint, Draft, Blockade, Bond, Inflation, Emancipation Proclamation, Casualty. In early 1861, Georgia joined with other southern states in a confederation whose main purpose became fighting a war to be independent from the United States. In the early years, the battlefields were in other states, but Georgia provided men and supplies for the war effort. The major military action in Georgia was on the coast. Some forts fell to the Union, and the port of Savannah was blockaded. Georgia was spared military damage in those years. However, people's lives were disrupted as schools closed and those left at home had to do their own work and the work of the men away in the army. Although some slaves along the coast fled to the Union Army in these early years, most remained slaves. Because Georgia was not under Union control in January 1863, the Emancipation Proclamation did not affect them until the military action of the war came to the state in 1864. Preparing for war. After secession, Georgia began preparing in case war came. But through the early spring, many Georgians did not believe that war would follow secession. Some wanted a speedy reunion with the Union if some agreements could be made with the North. Others simply hoped that they would remain independent and that the North would let them go. Those who supported secession believed that, since the states had voted to ratify the Constitution and join the United States, they also had the right to decide to leave the United States. They thought that the North was depriving them of their states' rights. Unionists believed that the Union of the States as a country could not be dissolved. They thought that the Constitution was a compact of we the people, and therefore the states could not pull out. Other Georgians had a strong belief that war would come. Cornelia Jones Pond, a planter's daughter in Liberty County, wrote in her memoirs that she had asked her father what would happen if Lincoln was elected, and he replied, "War." I will never forget with what horror that answer filled me. In the months between the election and the end of his term, President James Buchanan did not do anything to stop the states that seceded, although he personally believed that secession was illegal. He hoped that by not making them angry, something could be worked out. By the end of January 1861, 7 states in the Cotton Belt had seceded. All 7 sent delegates to a special convention in Montgomery, Alabama, where they voted to join together in what they considered a new country called the Confederate States of America. The president of that convention was Georgia's Howell Cobb. The new Confederate Constitution was based strongly on the rights of the individual states and had a weaker central government. The delegates chose Jefferson Davis of Mississippi as president and Alexander Stevens of Georgia as vice president. Robert Toombs became the Confederacy's Secretary of State, although he later resigned to become a brigade commander. In March, a few days after Abraham Lincoln became president, Georgia's secession convention delegates met again, this time in Savannah. The convention accepted the Confederate Constitution without sending it to the people for their vote. The delegates also wrote a new constitution for the state of Georgia. It was ratified in July by a vote of the people. Georgia Governor Joseph E. Brown, a strong believer in secession, had quickly started to make Georgia independent. He called for volunteers for 2 regiments for Georgia's protection. On January 3rd, even before secession, he had seized Fort Pulaski from the federal government and claimed it for Georgia. After secession, he began to occupy other important federal government properties that were within Georgia's boundaries, including the U.S. Mint, a factory that made gold and silver money, in Dahlonega, and the U.S. Arsenal in Augusta. Augusta was one of only 4 arsenals in the entire South. It was full of weapons, including 22,000 rifles and muskets, which would be important if fighting came. The beginning of the war. In South Carolina, the commander of Fort Sumter, located in Charleston Harbor, refused to surrender the fort. In his inaugural address, President Lincoln had made it clear that he was going to keep U.S. government property that was within the borders of the states that seceded. Although he did not want to start any fighting, Lincoln believed that he had to back the fort's commander. The fort was in desperate need of supplies, so Lincoln sent a supply expedition. He told South Carolina that he only wanted to get supplies to the men. In April 1862, the Confederate government learned that the supplies were coming with an armed escort. Confederate President Davis gave the order to take the fort. Since Major Robert Anderson, the fort's commander, would not surrender, the Confederates opened fire. 2 days later, the fort was forced to surrender. Lincoln now considered the Confederates to be in open rebellion against the government of the United States. He called for state militias to join him in putting down the rebellion. He asked for 90 days of service because he believed the rebellion would be over quickly. In fact, most people on both sides thought it would not last long. The war had begun. On both sides, citizens rallied behind their governments. volunteers joined their armies, inspired by ideas of glory and adventure. Many of the ordinary soldiers of the North were motivated by patriotism. In the South, ordinary Confederates, most of whom did not own slaves, wanted to defend their home and families. As the war wore on, average soldiers on both sides became less enthusiastic. By spring 1862, the Confederate government had to begin to draft men to serve. The following year, the Union did as well. A draft is a compulsory enrollment for military service. Before the surrender of Fort Sumter, 8 slave states of the Upper South were still part of the Union. After the war began, they had a different decision to make. Would they fight against fellow slave states? Virginia seceded very quickly, followed by North Carolina, Tennessee, and Arkansas. 4 others, Missouri, Kentucky, Maryland, and Delaware, decided not to secede, although their citizens were divided in how they felt about that. The western area of Virginia was so upset about Virginia's secession that it voted to form a new state, West Virginia, and rejoin the United States. The Union had many advantages going into the war. It had a much larger population and most of the manufacturing in the country. Almost all weapons were made in the North. The Navy belonged to the Union. The North also had a stronger national government, an asset in wartime. The Confederacy had the advantage of fighting in familiar surroundings and having the support of the local population. Even Southerners who had not supported secession believed that they had to defend their homes against invading troops. The Confederacy also hoped to get some economic and perhaps military aid from the British. They thought that the British would need Southern cotton for their textile mills. That is one reason they thought they might be able to defeat the more powerful Union. Georgia's contributions to the war effort. Georgia began to change as the state took part in the war. Georgia leaders encouraged the growing of food crops instead of cotton. In fact, Georgia became one of the major producers of food for the Confederate Army. The state also increased its manufacturing. Before the war, Georgia had bought most of the manufactured goods it needed from Europe or the North. Early in the war, the Union plan was to blockade, prevent access to, all Confederate ports. The Union naval blockade cut off most imports, although not all. Daring adventurers, called blockade runners, risked capture to bring in needed goods. These blockade runners, mostly private ships, made money and became heroes in the South, but their efforts were not enough. During the war, Georgia and the other Confederate states had to begin manufacturing their own goods. The port town of Savannah, along with the fall line towns of Augusta, Macon, Atlanta, and Columbus, became important industrial centers. Other towns like Athens, Rome, and Dalton also produced military goods. Savannah had one of the arsenals of the Confederacy. After a search throughout the South, Colonel George Washington Rains chose Augusta as the site for the Confederate powder works, which manufactured gunpowder for the entire Confederacy. In all the industries, women and blacks formed part of the workforce because so many men were off fighting. Women working in their own homes and in community places made cloth. Many women returned to the old-fashioned skills of spinning thread from raw fiber, then weaving it on looms into cloth. This is how many families, as well as many soldiers, were clothed during the war. Women often gathered together to sew the cloth. These sewing circles, as they were called, helped keep spirits up while they provided much-needed clothes, blankets, and bandaging for the troops. Textile mills in the state also produced as much cloth as they could, but there were not enough of them. Georgia had a good system of railroads, but the lines now had to carry much more freight and many more passengers as troops went to the battlefronts. Although Atlanta was already becoming a railroad center in the 1850s, the war made it a significant city. railroads met in Atlanta from all directions. The Confederate government made Atlanta a regional center for its quartermaster corps and commissary departments, which meant that goods for the armies were stored there until shipped to the places they were needed. Later in the war, that made Atlanta an important target for the Union Army. Georgia women and the war. The home front in Georgia and other Confederate states was held together in large part by women. Most white women were enthusiastic at the beginning of the war, even encouraging their men to fight. Gertrude Clanton Thomas was the daughter of one of the wealthiest planters in the Richmond-Columbia County area. As troops, including Thomas's husband, received their orders, she wrote, "And to this military company my husband belongs, holding the rank of first lieutenant, and I can write this without one wish to have him remain with me. When duty and honor call him, it would be strange if I would influence him to remain when so much is at stake." Throughout the Confederacy, white women encouraged or stood by their husbands. They wrote long letters to their men who were away. Some even traveled to the outskirts of encampments to be with their husbands near the battlefront. As the war dragged on, however, women's letters increasingly urged their men to come home. As men went off to war, women found themselves in far different roles from their pre-war duties. They took over the plantations, farms, and shops. They did what they could to raise money needed for the cause, founded aid organizations to help wounded soldiers, and by the end of the war, were nursing men that they had never met before, an unthinkable task before the war. They worked hard to grow food and even raise cash crops. The economy of war. One of the major problems the state and the entire Confederacy faced was the economy. Paying for the war was a challenge. The Confederate government passed a small tax on property at the beginning of the war. The state's governments were supposed to collect it, but most did not. The Confederacy also borrowed money by issuing bonds, but many, including planters, were unwilling to lend money to the government by buying the bonds. A bond is a document that serves as proof of a debt and that requires the payment of the debt plus interest. Most of the money to pay for the war was simply printed up without anything at all, like gold or silver, backing it up. This meant that the value of the money depended on the faith people had in the Confederate government. As the war continued and people became less sure that the Confederacy might win, the money became less valuable. Merchants demanded more of it to pay for goods. In other words, inflation began. Inflation occurs when prices of goods and services go up. The decreasing value of the money made many farmers less willing to sell their crops to the army if they were going to be paid with Confederate money. The army started simply taking what it needed and leaving behind IOUs that said the government owed the farmers money. Most of what the government owed was never paid. The economy was also affected by the Union blockade. Not only did the blockade keep goods from coming into the state, it also prevented goods from leaving. Farmers produced cotton, but could not ship it out to the British textile mills that wanted to buy it. Great Britain then began to buy cotton from India and Egypt. So money that normally came into the state through trade was cut off during the war. Because goods were not coming in, shortages occurred. Those on the home front had trouble getting the basics. Bread riots occurred in some Georgia towns. Even the army found it difficult to provide enough food, clothing, and shoes as the war progressed. The economy of the state was severely damaged by the end of the war. Page 393, the impact on schools and churches. Although Georgians were lucky that the actual fighting did not come their way until late 1863, many of the institutions of normal life were affected early when so many men left the state for battlefields in other states. Most of the state's colleges, including the University of Georgia, closed. Before the war, Georgia, under Governor Brown, had just begun to set up a public school system. That effort stopped. For the schools and academies that did remain open, more and more women became teachers. Before the war, most teachers were men. Like nursing, teaching became an acceptable occupation for females during the war. After the war, teaching and nursing became the two major professions available to women. The war also affected religion. In the beginning, both the Union and the Confederate sides thought that God was on their side. Although many ministers had been against secession, they supported the state once the fighting began. Ministers were not required to fight, but some did. Others became chaplains, trying to boost the spirits of soldiers. When the war began going badly for the Confederacy, some ministers came to believe that God was angry because of the way slaves had been treated. For example, slaves had not been allowed to learn to read, and so were unable to read the Bible. The laws against slave marriage were also seen as an evil. Some suggested God might be angry at a law passed late in the antebellum period that would not allow slaves to become preachers. This was especially troubling to Baptists, who believed that preaching was a call from God. If God had called slaves to preach and Georgia law had stopped them, perhaps God was upset. In spite of these concerns, the Georgia slave code did not change. In the end, many white Georgians could not explain why they lost the war if God was on their side. As Georgian John Jones wrote, "We must acknowledge that the providence of God has decided against us in the tremendous struggle." Early fighting. After the incident at Fort Sumter, Lincoln had called out the troops for 90 days, hoping for a speedy end to the rebellion. The general-in-chief of the U.S. Army was Winfield Scott, a hero from the Mexican-American War. Scott wanted to minimize fighting by using a naval blockade against southern ports. This, he thought, would make the South's economy collapse and make the South more likely to negotiate. But Northerners, outraged by the attack on Fort Sumter and by secession, were ready for action. Both sides geared up for the first showdown. In Georgia, Governor Brown had received a quick response to his call for volunteers. Thousands of Georgians joined up, but Brown hoped to keep Georgians and their weapons in the state for defense. He became one of the least cooperative governors with the Confederate government. He held back supplies in Georgia and tried to maintain a good fighting force. He wanted to be prepared if war came to Georgia. One Georgia colonel, Francis S. Bartow, took his Savannah unit of Oglethorpe Light Infantry Brigade to Virginia anyway, where he and many of his men met their deaths in the First Battle of Bull Run, known by the Confederates as the First Battle of Manassas. This battle made it clear that the war would not be over as quickly as either side predicted. Union soldiers with little training panicked and ran back toward Washington, D.C. The Confederate soldiers were also disorganized and did not follow the Union soldiers as they retreated. If they had, they might have had an even greater victory. Both Union and Confederate armies began to prepare for a longer war. Soon Georgians were on the battlefields of Virginia or Tennessee. Georgia's first experience with Union troops was near Savannah. After the firing on Fort Sumter, residents of Savannah thought that they would be the target of a Union invasion and prepared to defend the city. Fort Pulaski on Cockspur Island at the mouth of the Savannah River had been built in the 1820s to 1830s to guard the busy port. It had not been in use for some time when Governor Brown sent Georgia troops here in January 1861 before the Union could send troops. In fact, slaves had to be brought in to clear out the moat and help remount the cannon. In spite of the protection offered by the fort, many residents fled when the invasion of Hilton Head occurred in November. Wealthy Savannans packed up family valuables and headed inland. The commander at Savannah was Brigadier General William H. T. Walker, a Georgian. With the assistance of Confederate General Robert E. Lee, the city built batteries, fortified structures for artillery, and earthworks, embankments, and put stones and other obstructions in the river. Both Fort Pulaski and Fort Jackson received additional troops. Below Fort Jackson, Fort Bartow was built, and other forts went up on nearby rivers. But soldiers on Tybee and other islands were evacuated. In the fall of 1861, the Union general for the Savannah area decided to take Fort Pulaski and occupy some of the islands. Planters fled as Union troops occupied the coastal islands. Some slaves ran away to the Union lines, where they provided valuable information to the Union soldiers. From January until April 1862, Union soldiers built defenses on nearby Tybee Island. Most of the work was done at night, so the Georgians would not know what was happening. In April, the Union forces put in place a new, more modern cannon. On April 10th, Union Captain Quincy Gilmore demanded the surrender of Fort Pulaski. Confederate Colonel Charles Olmsted refused, and a bombardment of the fort began. 36 hours later, with huge holes in the fort's brick walls, Olmsted surrendered. Union soldiers occupied the fort from then until the end of the war. Union occupation of the fort made it impossible for ships to come into the port of Savannah, a major economic problem for Georgia throughout the war. Fort McAllister, built in 1861 on the Ogeechee River, never fell to the Union Navy in spite of 5 attempts to take it. The War in the East and the West. The major action of the war in the first 2 years happened away from Georgia. The Union forces divided into an army that would fight in the East and an army to fight in the West. The goal in the East was to take Virginia, especially Richmond, which had become the capital of the Confederacy after Virginia seceded. The Army of the West aimed at taking the Tennessee and Mississippi rivers, while the U.S. Navy under Admiral David Farragut took New Orleans, another important southern port. In Tennessee, in early 1862, Union General Ulysses S. Grant won 2 victories before the Confederates slowed him down. Then, in a surprise on April 6th, at a small church named Shiloh, the Confederates attacked. 2 days later, the Confederates had to withdraw. With about 20,000 men killed or wounded, the Battle of Shiloh was the bloodiest fighting that had happened thus far in the war. Meanwhile, Confederate General Robert E. Lee had just been appointed to head the Army of Northern Virginia at the beginning of June 1862. Lee was a West Point graduate from Virginia who had been in the U.S. Army since 1829. He had opposed slavery as evil, and he had also opposed secession. Yet, when Virginia pulled out of the Union, he resigned from the U.S. Army and went home, not willing to fight against his home. A few days later, he accepted the position of Commander-in-Chief of Virginia's military, and a few weeks later, a generalship in the Confederate Army. Lee managed to hold off Union forces in fierce fighting at what was called the 7 Days Battles from June 25th to July 1st, 1862. That saved Richmond from Union capture. Page 397, Antietam. Proud of his troops' performance in the 7 Days campaign, Lee decided to go on the offensive. After winning a victory in the Battle of Second Bull Run, Manassas, in late August 1862, Lee went north into Maryland. Hoping to continue his momentum after the victory at the Battle of Second Bull Run, Manassas, Lee had several goals. He wanted to influence the coming midterm elections in the Union. He also thought a Confederate victory might change public opinion about the war. He needed supplies, which he could get in Maryland. By moving the war out of Virginia, he would also take the fighting into the North, making them feel the sting of war. He believed that a victory might liberate Maryland, a slave state that remained in the Union. Lee's forces outnumbered 50,000 to 87,000 dug in for defense behind Antietam Creek near the town of Sharpsburg. Lee was opposed by Union Major General George B. McClellan's Army of the Potomac. McClellan's plan was to attack Lee's flanks, the left and right sides. Union forces attacked in the early morning hours, but they were driven back by the Confederates. For Union General Ambrose Burnside to attack the right flank, his troops had to cross a bridge, which was later named for him. Throughout that morning, a Georgia brigade, under the command of Robert Toombs, had fired at Union soldiers to keep them from crossing this crucial bridge over Antietam Creek. Toombs was wounded in the fighting. In spite of the Confederates' efforts, the Union broke through in the afternoon. However, by the time the Union troops regrouped on the other side, the Confederates' right flank had reinforcements. Despite vicious fighting, each army held its ground. The next day, the two armies gathered their wounded and buried their dead. That day, September 17, 1862, was the bloodiest one-day battle of not only the Civil War, but all U.S. wars. Almost 6,000 were killed and 17,000 wounded at the end of that day of savage fighting. Several thousand of the wounded later died. During the night of September 18th, Lee retreated back into Virginia while Union General McClellan's troops began the grim task of burying the dead. The Emancipation Proclamation. In the summer of 1862, Abraham Lincoln had made the decision to tear down the institution of slavery. Beyond just the moral question of enslaving people was the fact that Southern slaves working in the fields meant that Southern white men could fight the North. Lincoln tried to find a way to free the slaves without causing the secession of the four slave states that had remained in the Union. Congress had abolished slavery in Washington, D.C. in April 1862 and in all U.S. territories in June of that year. Up to that point, all slaves who escaped to the Union Army or were captured had been considered captured property. In July, Congress declared all of them and any slaves who came to the Union Army in the future to be free. During the summer, Lincoln drafted the Emancipation Proclamation. Emancipation is the act of freeing enslaved people. But he waited until he had a victory to make the announcement. Antietam, in spite of the horrible loss of life, was that victory. The Emancipation Proclamation said that, on January 1, 1863, slaves in the areas still in rebellion would become free. However, it did not apply to slaves in the border states that had remained in the Union. Because the United States did not control those areas still in rebellion, the Confederate states, no slaves became free on January 1st. But as the Union Army conquered areas of the South, slaves became free. Not everyone in the North was happy with the Emancipation Proclamation. The Northern Democrats believed that emancipation by the national government was unconstitutional in states where it had been legal. Many ordinary Northerners believed in preserving the Union, but not necessarily in freeing slaves, at least not until the fighting was done. In spite of the opposition, Lincoln signed the Emancipation Proclamation on January 1, 1863, and asked slaves to refrain from violence. The proclamation that affected the rebellious states caused people in other slave states to make changes. Missouri and Maryland freed their slaves. The three states that were already occupied by Union forces also abolished slavery. To make sure that other states did not bring slavery back after the war, Congress and Lincoln supported a permanent amendment to the U.S. Constitution that would make slavery unconstitutional. In Georgia and other southern states, white slaveholders feared if slaves found out about the proclamation, they might rebel. Jefferson Davis responded with a proclamation that all free blacks captured by the Confederacy would become slaves. Vicksburg and Gettysburg. Meanwhile, the war continued in the East and West. In the West, Union General Ulysses S. Grant had failed to take Vicksburg, Mississippi, in the first attempt in the winter of 1862 and 1863. While the Union controlled the area north of Vicksburg, the troops found themselves stuck in Mississippi's swamps and mud, trying to get around the town's defenses. Beginning on April 16th, Grant's gunboats and transports began to run the Confederate batteries. On April 30th, Grant's troops crossed to the east side of the river. Instead of attacking Vicksburg immediately from May 1st to May 17th, Grant's troops defeated Confederates at the state capital, Jackson, and in four other places. When they attacked Vicksburg, however, they still could not take the heavily fortified town. They instead began to dig in and, for the next few weeks, laid siege. The town finally surrendered on July 4, 1863, after 6 weeks of being bombarded by cannon fire. This important victory gave the Union control of the Mississippi River. Meanwhile, in the East, the Confederates had won a major victory in Virginia in May, when General Robert E. Lee's troops defeated a Union force almost twice as large at Chancellorsville. It was a remarkable victory against heavy odds. After 2 years of fighting in the East, the Union had not been able to conquer Virginia. With Lee's victory in Virginia and Grant's inability to take Vicksburg in Mississippi, Northern morale was low in May 1863. Confident of his troops after such a victory, Lee decided to try once again to invade Union territory, this time Pennsylvania. Lee hoped that a victory in the North might make the Union less willing to continue fighting. Confederate leaders also hoped that a Confederate victory might persuade the British and the French to recognize the Confederacy as an independent country. In June 1863, Lee's army of 75,000 men headed north through Maryland into Pennsylvania. The Battle of Gettysburg was a turning point in the Civil War. The newly appointed commander of the Union Army of the Potomac, General George Gordon Meade, had been sent to protect Washington and Baltimore. As Meade's troops headed into Northern Territory, they were welcomed by the citizens, giving a needed boost to their morale. Union troops ran into Lee's troops almost by accident on July 1st. From the beginning, the historic battle was a series of mistakes, arguments, and accidents. First, the fighting started before either army had all of its soldiers in Gettysburg. Second, Confederate General J.E.B. Stuart and his cavalry had gone off in another direction and could not be contacted. Third, Georgia-born General James Longstreet disagreed with Lee's tactics and wanted to get the Confederate troops between the Union Army and Washington. Lee rejected that strategy. On July 2nd, as Lee led his troops for a frontal attack, Longstreet and his men were late getting into position. When they finally did, the Union troops were on higher ground than the Confederates originally thought. Longstreet attacked anyway. The bloodiest battle raged on and on. On the third day of the battle, perhaps the best-known fighting took place. General George E. Pickett led over 14,000 Confederate troops across an open field toward the Union forces on Cemetery Ridge. The Confederate lines were torn apart by Union artillery and rifle fire. In less than an hour, 7,000 Confederates had become casualties, those killed, wounded, or missing. And the attack, forever known as Pickett's Charge, was history. Union General Meade could have counterattacked, but he did not. He believed they had done well enough. Lee was forced to retreat into Virginia, ending the hopes of the Confederacy for victory. In the battle, Confederate casualties numbered about 28,000, and Union casualties were about 23,000. News of the victory reached Washington, D.C. on July 4th, making the celebration even greater. 3 days later, news of the Vicksburg victory arrived. The tide of war had turned. After the Battle of Gettysburg, the remaining battles of the Civil War were fought on Southern soil. Any Confederate hopes of foreign recognition were also ended. In November of that year, President Lincoln went to the battlefield to dedicate it as a national military cemetery. Lincoln's famous 2-minute speech is known as the Gettysburg Address. The defeat at Gettysburg made many in the South begin to talk about peace negotiations. President Jefferson Davis became increasingly unpopular. Another effect of Lee's defeat at Gettysburg was the British decision to remain neutral and not help the Confederacy. In spite of the negative effects on the Confederacy, the Union victories at Vicksburg and Gettysburg did not bring the war to an end. Reviewing the section, 1. Define mint, draft, bond, inflation. 2. Which Georgian was chosen as the Vice President of the Confederacy? 3. What was the purpose of the Union's blockade? 4. What resources would cause the most trouble for the South and be the greatest advantage to the North? Page 402. Discovering Georgia's Past. The Great Locomotive Chase. In the spring of 1862, Union forces were in Alabama planning to capture Huntsville before attacking Chattanooga, Tennessee. Kentuckian James Andrews, a merchant who traded between the Union and Confederate lines, offered to lead a raid to disable the Western and Atlantic Railroad. Disabling the railroad would prevent supplies and perhaps reinforcements from getting to the Confederates in Chattanooga. Union General Mitchell Ormsby accepted the offer, and Union soldiers from Ohio regiments volunteered, including a few who had been railroad engineers. On the morning of April 12, 1862, the General, a train owned by the Western and Atlantic Railroad that carried both passengers and war supplies, left Atlanta. At 5 a.m., it arrived in Marietta, where Andrews and his men, all disguised in civilian clothing, boarded. The train stopped for breakfast at Big Shanty Station, now Kennesaw. Conductor William Fuller and his crew were eating breakfast when they heard a familiar sound, the noise of the General and 3 boxcars pulling out of the station. Stunned, Fuller and his crew raced out the door and began running after the train. A 7-hour pursuit began. The raiders had chosen to make their move at Big Shanty Station because it had no telegraph. Along the way, they would cut telegraph lines, burn bridges, and destroy railroad tracks. What they did not count on was the spirit and determination of Fuller and his crew, who took the theft as a personal affront. After running along the tracks for 2 miles, Fuller and his men found a platform handcar. They pushed themselves along the tracks, picking up 2 more men to help them. They came upon the switch engine Yona, which they commandeered. At Kingston, they picked up the engine William F. Smith, only to abandon it because the Union raiders had removed tracks. Finally, after still another foot pursuit, the weary but angry band of men met an engine named Texas heading south from Adairsville. They quickly climbed aboard and continued the pursuit. Since the Texas had been heading south, it had to pursue in reverse. The General, which had been slowed by southbound train traffic, was north of Calhoun when the Union raiders saw an incredible sight. The mighty Texas, without any cars, was barreling down the railroad tracks backward. Andrews' raiders were now filled with fear. The law was very clear about the sentencing of spies. The raiders first tried unsuccessfully to pry up the rails. Next, they tossed cross ties onto the tracks to stop their pursuers. Then they released 2 boxcars, but the Texas pushed them aside. As they approached the wooden bridge over the Oostenaula River, Andrews set fire to the last boxcar, hoping that it would burn the bridge and stop the Texas. But the bridge was too wet from the previous day's rains to burn. Again, the Texas pushed aside the burning boxcar and continued its chase. The race finally ended near Ringgold Gap, 18 miles south of Chattanooga, when the General ran out of steam. The raiders fled but were rounded up within 2 weeks. 2 months later, James Andrews and 7 of his men were court-martialed and hanged in Atlanta. The remaining men were sent to Confederate prisons. 6 of them escaped, and 8 were exchanged for Confederate prisoners. Some later wrote stories of their exploit. After the war, the soldiers of Andrews' raiders received the Medal of Honor. However, because Andrews was not in the military, he did not. Today, the general can be seen at the Southern Museum of Civil War and Locomotive History in Kennesaw. The Texas is on display at the Cyclorama in Atlanta.